This is Take Care, a health and wellness show covering the latest in medicine, technology, human behavior, and more. I'm Jason Smith.
And I'm Catherine Loper. Your parents will tell you that things aren't the way they used to be, at least not when they were kids. And as overplayed as the saying may be, they're right when it comes to health information.
Understanding what's best for your health and wellness has never been easy, but with details about procedures, doctor reviews, and worst-case scenarios scattered all over the internet, the real issue seems to be cutting through the noise.
Some things are easier, at least on the surface. For the most part, there's no more tracking down the paper trail of your latest vaccination. Doctors are sending files to specialists and emergency rooms with ease, or so you might think.
Today we're exploring health information, your information, the information out there, and what you should be doing with it all. First we ask, where do people get their health information?
Joining us to discuss this is Dr. Nilay Kumar. He teaches at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and the research we'll discuss today has a lot to do with the question of what people are looking for on the internet when it comes to health information. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Kumar.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you for having me on your show.
So let's start out with, how has the ability of ordinary people to find health information changed over the years? Obviously, the internet has had a big effect.
So I think about a couple of decades ago, when the internet was not available, most of the health information was obtained by patients from their primary care physicians or by way of health campaigns that were run by professional organizations like the American Heart Association or other government agencies like the Centers for Disease Control. With the advent of the internet over the last decade or so, a lot of the patients are now finding all of their information on the internet. In fact, the Pew Organization conducted a study where they found that approximately 80% of Americans look for their information online. And that raises certain challenges about the quality of information that patients are receiving.
Is the internet helping or hurting people as they try to get information about their own health?
So I think the democratization of information that has happened with the internet has a huge potential to empower patients with regards to their chronic illnesses and with regards to preventative care. One of the biggest challenges, though, is that misinformation has spread rapidly with the advent of the internet. So I think while we have huge opportunities to improve patients' care by empowering them and by helping them in self-management of chronic conditions, the biggest challenge is the spread of misinformation.
Are you seeing some dangers in patients trying to self-diagnose rather than calling their doctor? I mean, what are the dangers there?
One of the biggest dangers is that some of the diagnoses may not be as accurate. If we take a specific example of hypertension, it is quite straightforward to measure your own blood pressure using an automated blood pressure device. However, depending on the time of the day or depending on the technique of measurement, you can actually get a lot of variation in your own blood pressure measurements throughout the day. Therefore, it's important to be able to measure your blood pressure using the correct technique and using the recommended guidelines. So it's quite easy to come up with erroneous diagnoses based on some of the information that you find on the internet. It's always a good idea to make sure that you double check with your primary care provider and make sure that some of the concerns you have are actually legitimate concerns.
Is it often that patients request treatment based on their own research? Does that happen very often?
It does happen very often because a lot of times from our own research, we have found that videos and websites that purport to sell alternative treatments, they get shared and liked a lot more often than videos and websites that actually have valid information.
Right. It's hard for the ordinary person to know the difference between a study that's been validated by the FDA and something that's just kind of out there.
Yeah, it's certainly the case because many of the websites and videos that peddle treatments that have not been validated actually make sometimes very sensational claims, and those tend to be consumed by viewers a lot more than some of the more traditional sources of information, such as those from professional organizations or from universities.
Is there anything that could be done to help stop the spread of incorrect, wrong health information? We have freedom of speech in this country, so that may be hard, but is there anything that can be done to kind of stop that bad information from going viral?
You know, as we've seen in the last year or two, there's been a huge focus on fake news and on sensational claims going viral on social media and free messaging platforms like WhatsApp. So I think there has to be a balance between people being able to express their views versus those who are, you know, engaging in conspiracy theories and spreading sensational claims about cures of chronic diseases that may not be validated. So I think the government and professional societies and universities can all play a huge role in helping patients navigate this terrain of misinformation versus the truth. Much of it will depend on what regulations are framed by the government in the coming years.
Some of your research shows increases or jumps in particular kind of health searches on the web at specific times during the year. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. We recently published a paper in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings where we looked at how healthcare information with respect to cardiovascular disease is obtained by users over the last 10 years. So we hypothesized that parallel to this increase in incidence and mortality, we would see an increase in web search activity during winter months. And we obtained data from Google in order to answer these questions. And we found that during winter months, people were looking at a lot more information with respect to cardiovascular disease problems like hypertension or myocardial infarction or heart failure compared with summer months. We also conducted an analysis where we looked at the correlation between the incidence of cardiovascular disease by state within the United States and how people in these states were looking at information with respect to cardiovascular disease on the internet. And we found that there was actually a positive correlation between the information that was being obtained from the internet versus the real world incidence of cardiovascular disease.
You know, 30 years ago, you wouldn't have thought anyone would get this much health information from the internet. Do you have any guesses as to where our health information is going to come from 30 years from now or in the future? How will it change?
I think we are going to see an increasing trend in the democratization of information. The information asymmetry that used to exist between healthcare providers and patients is going to continue to decrease. And for the most part, that is a really good thing because that helps patients get empowered with respect to chronic disease conditions, and that helps patients take ownership of their own disease processes. But with the proliferation of smartphone and internet-based technologies, we definitely are going to come up against more challenges with respect to the spread of misinformation.
Well, I appreciate you pointing out the good and the bad about where we're getting our health information. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Kumar.
Thank you, Catherine.
Dr. Nilay Kumar is Clinical Assistant Professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. You can find more on the research we discussed today online.
Catherine, I was thinking about starting a juice cleanse. What do you think?
I think you might be hungry.
I think you might be right. According to our next guest, the problem with health and wellness is that it's not all healthy and it won't all make you well. From juice cleanses to
something called vagina steams,
to toxin-absorbing foot baths and infrared saunas or trampoline exercise classes, there's a lot out there that will make you fit, clean, all natural, and healthy, or so they say.
And what did Dr. Conlon say was wrong with you, Mrs. Brady?
Well, it's real complicated, Dr. Gillespie. It's something about the electricity. It's in my joints and my liver when it ought to be out in my fingertips.
Oh, to be sure, yeah.
Machine didn't seem to help me much, but he said if I'd keep on, it'd just happen overnight. That's how it works.
Just like magic, huh?
He had all kinds of letters from people he's cured. I went to him regular until I couldn't afford it anymore.
By the darnation. Jimmy,
I know.
Timothy Caulfield has spent most of his career trying to find out if there's any evidence behind these wellness trends, even the ones you may think are as good as fact. Caulfield is a researcher, author, and professor of health law and science policy at the University of Alberta. He joins us today to suss out these supposed health practices and to help us understand why there's so much bad health information out there to begin with. Thanks for joining us today, Tim.
Well, thanks for the opportunity.
So, decades ago, if you needed information about your health, you likely went to your doctor and had a conversation. But today, we are just bombarded by health information from everywhere, and that seems like it would be great, but not all of the information is good. So, can you tell us how much of that health information that's coming at us from everywhere do you think is just wrong?
Oh, A lot. It really is an incredible amount of misinformation right now. And it's not just coming from celebrities, which, you know, they often get the blame. It's everywhere. You know, you're seeing it on clinic websites. You're seeing it on websites that are allegedly health information websites. So it's becoming, I think, increasingly difficult to tease out what is accurate and what is inaccurate. In addition to that, it is getting transmitted, right, by various forces, including social media. And we've studied this phenomenon at the Institute. You're seeing a lot of misinformation on social media. And of course, there are these confirmation bubbles, right? You know, people are talking to each other, people who already agree with whatever the conclusion might be. So it is becoming, I think, a really problematic phenomenon.
So is bad health information sort of like viral video? It just keeps spreading?
It is. It is. You know, there's been really interesting research that has shown that things that are untrue, right, fake news, travels faster than the truth. It travels faster and further than the truth. And of course, part of that is it's probably more interesting, right? So there's bad information everywhere, and that bad information has legs.
So is it hard to combat the information because of that? I mean, you would think you could just find the science to disprove claims that are bogus, and that would be the end of that. But it seems like it's really hard to combat the bad information.
It is incredibly difficult. You know, research has shown that in general, just dumping accurate information on people won't change their minds, right? Once they have formed an opinion about something, whether it is a crazy diet or something serious like vaccination, it can be really hard to change people's minds. But there is hope. There are studies that have been done that have shown that you can use various strategies, you know, using narratives and storytelling that is relevant to people, you know, speaks to their values. Yes, continue to say what the science says, you know, make sure the science is accurate, but then think of creative communication strategies that can be deployed to convey that science. And there is some hope that that'll work. But look, it is an uphill battle.
Why is it so easy for all of us to believe these claims about health? Are we just searching for, you know, sort of the fountain of youth?
I think that's part of it. But I also think that there is a little bit of a breakdown in trust of traditional sources of scientific information. Interesting research has shown, for example, a great decline in the amount of trust people have in their physicians, which is, I think in the 70s, it was around 75% of Americans would say they had great confidence in their physicians. And now it's, I think, in the 30s, right? So it's a real decline. There are concerns about how science is produced now, you know, conflicts of interest, big pharma, big agriculture. I hear that all the time in my hate mail, by the way. You know, we got to learn from that, right? There are those trust issues. And I also think that people may have had a bad experience with conventional healthcare. Perhaps they feel like they're not being listened to or their problems aren't being taken seriously. You know, those things, I think, are contributing to the drive towards this misinformation and creating space for alternative voices.
So if people are having a harder time believing what used to be considered traditional, trustworthy health information sources, they're believing celebrities more than ever on health and nutrition and fitness issues. So why is that?
Well, I'm not really sure people necessarily believe celebrities. Like, if we went outside right now and we did a poll and we asked everyone, do you think Gwyneth Paltrow is a reliable source of health information? I think most people would say no, but they have a big megaphone, right? They are able to keep these ideas alive and they give these ideas a lot of currency. So even if you don't necessarily believe the person who's saying it, you know, people like Gwyneth or Jenny McCarthy or Tom Brady, for example, they allow this misinformation to circulate. In addition to that, they often have a brand that people relate to. So even if you don't necessarily believe Tom, I'm a big Tom Brady fan, so I'm using him as an example. You don't necessarily believe Tom Brady's take on diet and exercise, you may still relate to the message that he is transmitting. And research shows that that can also have an impact on our choices.
Well, and you see before your eyes that he's a very fit, seemingly very healthy guy, too.
Really excellent point. I think that goes to the power of the anecdote, the power of the testimonial. And the Jenny McCarthy story is a good example of that. Of course, she is one of the individuals that has spread the myth, and it is a complete myth. There's no evidence to support it at all, that vaccinations contribute to the development of autism. You know, that really is not true. But when she started telling her story, that story was compelling, right? It was a story about a mother watching her her child get autism. And that, you know, that kind of compelling story can overwhelm all of the available evidence, right? So I think that that is one of the things, one of the reasons that celebrities can have so much sway. And the Tom Brady example is really good, right? I mean, it works for him, right? He's doing so well. Maybe it'll work for me.
And there are examples out there of things that kind of do seem ridiculous as health cures, but there are also examples of where people, you know, take seriously some quack cures for real serious health conditions, right?
That's right. And that's, you know, one of the areas that we do a lot of work on here. This is, you know, not just about, you know, frivolous things like anti-aging or something like that. A lot of these cures are being offered for serious stuff, you know, cancer, developmental disabilities. We study, for example, the marketing of unproven stem cell therapies, and these therapies can cost tens of thousands of dollars, and they are often marketed to communities that are desperate, right? It can be tremendously problematic.
Health has become intertwined with wellness and things like fitness and beauty and that sort of thing. So how closely are these now intertwined in our head, and is that a good thing?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. You know, the wellness industry, and however you define that, is now a multi-trillion dollar industry, right? And I think that increasingly they have become intertwined. And it's almost now that we are all obligated to do whatever we can all the time to try to improve our health, or, you know, and our well-being. Often I think the messaging is not that constructive, right? In reality, beyond, you know, socioeconomics and you know, choosing your parents, you get most of the bang from not smoking, exercising, eating real food, sleeping, you know, loving someone. There is really no magic. But people are constantly trying to sell magic as part of this massive wellness industry.
What are some of the things people should look out for as we're trying to sort through information ourselves, health information, like some of the things you would recommend to the average consumer to not be swayed by less than reliable sources?
Well, I think one of the things, we've touched on it, you know, never be swayed by a testimonial. And that's really hard, especially if it's someone that you can relate to. A testimonial, an anecdote may be interesting, but it's not good science. Look for a body of evidence. You know, don't rely on a single study, you know, which is you often see on a website. For a lot of these things, you need a body of evidence. Humans are complex, right? It's not going to be one study. It's going to require a lot of work. Be suspicious of anything that claims to be really powerful. Unfortunately, there aren't that many interventions out there that are tremendously powerful. So if there are these grand claims being made, be suspicious, right? And then try to find reliable sources of independent science that you can turn to, that you feel speak to you, and try to triangulate. Look for a number of sources. Don't be fooled by the grand claims.
Since you look at this all the time, where do you think this is going? We've sort of reached this place where we have all this health information. Is this going to keep going in that direction, or do you think this is cyclical?
I think it's going to get increasingly complex. I don't think this is going away. Unfortunately, we're starting to see it a little bit spread, right? It's spreading beyond just celebrity culture. We're starting to see a lot of things that are being offered that don't have good science behind them. And sometimes they're being portrayed as if they are scientific. Stem cells is a good example. The microbiome, now you're starting to see a lot of microbiome products out there. So I do think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I think that increasingly we need more people, more from the science community, more from the healthcare community, getting involved in public discourse on these topics.
Okay, well, that helps us a lot. And we will go forth and look at the internet with skepticism when it comes to health information. So thanks so much for joining us today, Tim.
Thank you.
Timothy Caulfield is a researcher, author, and professor at the University of Alberta. Caulfield is author of the books Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? And The Cure for Everything, among others. And you can now watch the series he hosts on Netflix. It's called A User's Guide to Cheating Death.
We have to take a break here, but when we return, we'll explore why medical reversals happen, how they're harmful, and what can be done to avoid them. You're listening to Take Care. Thank you.
You're listening to Take Care, a health and wellness show from WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. Today, we're picking apart the topic of health information. Part of the issue with finding the best health information is that it can often seem contradictory, and we're not just talking about the latest advice on whether your baby should sleep on its back or stomach.
When it comes to medical reversal, things can become grave pretty fast. For example, a widely used prescription medication can be taken off the shelves after it's found not to help or even to hurt patients.
Now, in a perfect world, medicine should progress in an orderly fashion, with good practices being replaced by better ones. But we're not living in a perfect world. Our next guest explains why medical reversals are harmful and avoidable. Dr. Vinay Prasad is a hematologist-oncologist and associate professor of medicine at Oregon Health and Science University. He spoke with our producer, Leah Landry.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
When it comes to medicine, our understanding of what's best for a patient can change over time due to new advances made in research, clinical trials, things like that. You write that it makes sense for good practices to be replaced by better ones and so on and so forth. But you also say that that isn't always the case. Could you expand on that for us?
Yeah, I think many of us wish and think of medicine as a series of incremental advances. What's new today was better than what we had yesterday. And I think for many things, that narrative is correct. That's true. That does capture much of biomedicine. But there's another type of story in biomedicine we don't talk quite as much about. And those are practices that we deploy, we extol, we use for many, many years that in retrospect are found to be no better or even worse than a prior standard of care or even in some cases doing nothing.
So what is medical reversal?
We define medical reversal as just those things, the missteps in medicine. These aren't things that were replaced with something better. These were practices that in retrospect we probably never should have done. If we had had the good studies up front, we might never have done them, and they probably were no better or worse than doing nothing or doing what we did before.
So I always like to get the historical context behind this. So I'm wondering, is the problem of medical reversal a recent one, or has this been ongoing?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it has very likely been there throughout all of medical practice. Actually, probably the bulk of medical practice for thousands of years consisted of many, many interventions that just simply did not work, that didn't do what we thought they did. You can think about bloodletting or trepanation, which is drilling holes into skulls and all sorts of what are now thought barbaric practices. But in recent years, we still continue to see some new drugs and devices and surgeries being deployed, lacking good evidence. And we still see some practices that we've recently adopted being contradicted. And that's what we kind of focus on in our research. Why are we still making these mistakes? Is it possible that we can adopt more of what actually works and less of what doesn't?
You write about a lot of instances where doctors just won't drop something, even if it is shown not to help or in some cases even to harm. This is a naive sounding question, but I think it's a good place to start. Why would anyone continue to call for a procedure or, let's say, prescribe a drug if research is telling them it's just not working?
Yeah, and I think this is a very good question, and it gets at sort of the heart of the psychology of a physician. I think most doctors, the vast majority of physicians, are very well-intentioned. They're truly doing what they believe in their heart is best for patients. They've done that, you know, day in and day out for their careers. And I think it's very difficult when you tell someone who's been doing something for a decade or more, and they've truly believed they helped their patients, and they may even have gotten some anecdotal reinforcement from people who say, boy, that really did feel like it worked for me. And you couple that with just a small financial incentive to do that procedure, I think that combination is a highly addictive substance. And breaking that habit in a physician is often very difficult. And simply generating better and more credible evidence is often not enough to break that addiction. And so we see tremendous reluctance among providers who have done things for a long period of time to let it go, even when faced with very clear, indisputable, very strong evidence that it doesn't work.
How hard is it to, let's say, make a medical reversal, to get people who were essentially believing that we were in a good place with something to now go back to something that could be seen as antiquated?
or to simply to just to de-adopt the practice that doesn't work. I think it's very difficult. It's difficult in several ways. One, it's difficult to build the consensus to even test these practices. You know, the reversals that we've documented are things that at least some courageous physicians felt like maybe it doesn't do what we think it does, and they were willing to put it to rigorous testing. Even to build that consensus, that's an arduous task that takes years, and in some fields, that consensus never builds, and we don't even test it. Then the next step is you test it, and you get a result that runs counter to what you may have felt before, or a bunch of data that was really of a lower quality of data, uncontrolled, anecdotal, sort of ways in which data is not as good as the contradictory study. And then you have to get people to believe the contradictory study and to change their practice patterns. And that often requires some nudges, maybe from payers saying that, you know, we're not going to always reimburse for this unless you have a good justification why this practice is different in this situation. It may require a nudge from professional organizations to say, we have to reevaluate how we think about this. And getting those nudges requires, you know, the work of politics. It's changing minds and changing attitudes, and that's very difficult. So at every step along the way, there is resistance to medical reversal, I think.
So are there a few key things that you could point to that's really causing the problem? Is it the clinical trials or pressure for hospitals to look like they're on the forefront of treatment?
I think that you're hitting the nail on the head, that it's, you know, what is causing this problem? Why haven't we learned the lessons of the past? Why isn't more of what we adopt enduring and actually works? And the simple reason is we jump onto new therapies or practices before we've done the conclusive, robust studies. We do that in part because we're enthusiastic about new things. I think human beings are incredibly enthusiastic. That's one of the best things about us. That's a good thing. And we also do it because all of the for-profit motives in the system encourage the rapid and hasty adoption of new therapies. Manufacturers of products really don't benefit from waiting to conduct the definitive studies to judge their product. They benefit much more from just deploying the product and encouraging its use. If you already have access to the market, you can only lose by testing your product rigorously. You can only have the chance of losing your market share. So we don't see, you know, the strong interest among the biomedical industry testing their own products very rigorously. We want the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. We want third parties to hold these products to that standard. That's what we need from regulatory agencies. But we see regulatory agencies under tremendous pressure to just approve more and more products. And we see some leaders of regulatory agencies celebrating, boy, we approved 20 drugs last year. And that's good. We want new drugs. But the real question is how many of those drugs improve how long people live, how well they live, how many are certain, and how many are still uncertain. Merely approving new products is not the judge of success. Those have to be products that actually work.
Do you think that medical reversals can really be avoided? I mean, that's a significant shift in the way that people think and do business and just go about their day to day.
Right. And that's a great question. I would say that even in the most optimal system, there will be some rate of reversal. There will always be some medical practices that will never be 100% there. Not everything we do will be perfect. But the current rates of reversal that we're tolerating, these are things we've studied in many papers, the rates of reversal we're tolerating are very, very high. They're far higher than the uncertainty of science and statistics. They are as high as they are because there's so much pressure to have a very low bar to debut a medical practice. And if we did a few things to actually test these products a little bit better before they come to market, we would dramatically reduce reversal. You know, the reason I think reversal is so concerning is not only are patients harmed, the patients who undergo the practice during the years it fell in favor, the patients who continue to undergo the practice before doctors change their mind about it and actually are persuaded, but the deepest harm of reversal is loss of trust in biomedicine and science and medicine. And we live at a time where there are so many people who are quick to question science. I disagree strongly with those people. I think science is the best path forward. But we can't give them ammunition by failing to test our own hypotheses rigorously.
Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today, Dr. Prasad.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
That was Leah Landry speaking with Dr. Vinay Prasad. He teaches at Oregon Health and Science University. You can find many of the ideas discussed today in Ending Medical Reversal. Dr. Prasad is co-author of the book.
This room? It's hardly equipped.
Most of my equipment, Doctor, fits right into that black bag. My laboratory travels with me.
Well, how are you able to keep up on the current studies, on research?
Well, Doctor, not here doesn't give a man much time for study, research. You're too busy keeping folks alive any way you can. whether it's in the book or not.
We've already talked a bit about medical records in this episode. I'm sure many of you listening right now have to log into an online patient portal to get details of your last visit instead of waiting for results to come in the mail. Electronic medical records have, for the most part, replaced paper records in most health settings, but in the huge and varied medical world, there's room for improvement. Ellen Abbott reports.
Greg Kenyon has a bird's-eye view of the changing world of medical records. He's the chief medical information officer at St. Joseph's Hospital in Syracuse, as well as a cardiologist.
Ultimately, the potential is enormously for the good, but we're having some growing pains now.
On the plus side, he likes the potential of using these medical records to track populations to determine who may be at risk for certain illnesses. For example, at St. Joe's, they're installing a predictive analytic model to determine who may be at most risk for sepsis, a potentially life-threatening complication of infection.
Instead of just looking at your pulse and your blood pressure and your white count and your respiratory rate, which are pretty good indicators, we're going to put in 120 data points from your hospital chart. What's your kidney function? What's your liver function? How old are you? Do you have a problem with narcotics? Put in 120 things, and then the model will tell us, hopefully, and then learn from itself, people who are at risk for sepsis.
The hospital would then know to monitor those individuals more closely. The use of electronic medical records also helps on a more individual level, slashing drug interaction rates and offering patients the opportunity to keep track of their own health data. But not all healthcare facilities have the same needs. Loretto is a post-acute care facility in Syracuse. Chief Information Officer Brandon Clapp says it's moving towards a new electronic medical record system that will integrate medical records in all aspects of care, from skilled nursing settings to rehabilitation units.
The acute care space, hospitals, they're much more far advanced in the capabilities of their EMR because they have large vendors. Now, the post-acute care space, I think, is coming up there and coming on to being able to have data at your fingertips, and I think the demand will be there from the population.
Chances are, though, the vendor used by Loretto isn't the same one used by St. Joe's, which leads to one of the biggest challenges in the digital record world, interoperability, the difficulty of one software program to talk to another and transfer records in a usable manner. Karen Fabrizio, chair of the Health Information Technology Program at Onondaga Community College, says part of that can be eased through health information exchanges.
Within New York State, there are 8. A lot of people refer to them as RIOs. They're regional health information organizations. And these are organizations that take data from the facility and they hold it into a repository. There's a lot of protocol in place for making sure a physician or a hospital has access to that information.
That access to information, though, doesn't entirely solve the added burden of disparate systems that don't allow seamless transfer of information. Kenyon hopes that can be overcome with improvements in medical software.
I think medical software is behind where consumer software is. So as that medical software gets better and more friendly to doctors, patients, and nurses, that things will improve.
On the ground, the use of electronic medical records gets mixed reviews. Clapp says the new system will help nurses at Loretto.
So it's going to allow our nurses to spend more time with the residents and less time worrying about different pieces of paper, having to fax to one location or another, or documentation. It all is going to be able to done with finger clicks instead of a timely consumption of data.
Kenyon says from a physician's point of view, all the extra screen time can take away from patient time, and beyond that.
And sometimes you can get swamped. Sometimes there's so much information that the one important piece you miss.
But in the end, he believes doctors would never go back to paper.
It's nice to be able to read a note, even if it has a little more information that you have to look through. But every note is legible, and the immediate ability to look at your heart cath that you had a month ago, or an echocardiogram, a scan of your heart that you had done 6 months ago, to be able to look at it at my desk and not have to walk to the echo lab or the cath lab and look at it. Or if the emergency room calls, I can look at your EKG and your records without leaving my house. I don't think any of us would go back to the old days.
I'm Ellen Abbott for Take Care.
We're with you today talking about medical information. We've covered the ways in which people get information today, a far cry from what things were like before the internet.
Nurse?
Yes, sir.
You find the records?
I just finished.
I wish I could let you see them, Mr. Barclay.
I ask you to reconsider, nurse. It's a matter of life and death.
Yes, sir, you explained, and I'm awfully sorry for your sister.
Think of that young girl.
And some of the hiccups encountered now that we're living in the information age.
Speaking of the information age, how often have you been doing research, maybe for work or maybe for your own personal health, and have come across a medical study?
It's happened a few times, I think, but some of them are a little difficult to distill. And thank goodness for abstracts, all I can usually stomach is the summary of the findings.
It occurred to the Take Care team that maybe not all of us remember those college days, combing through the latest studies to make our point in that big paper. And when it comes to medical studies, is a clinical trial done on rats as important as a trial with humans as the subjects? For more on how to understand medical studies, we speak to Olivia Sistinas, a librarian at the Health Sciences Library at Upstate Medical University in Syracuse. Thanks for being with us, Olivia.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So is it in our interest to learn how to read a medical study as the average person? Can that information really help us make more informed decisions about our health?
So there's more and more information available to the average consumer, and quality information really helps you make better healthcare decisions. So getting in touch with those primary studies is only going to aid in your ability to make better healthcare decisions for yourself and your family.
But for the average person who's not a researcher, it can be kind of scary to look at all that information. So is there an easy way you would recommend to distill that information found in a medical study?
There's a couple things that I would recommend when you're going to look at a study. A lot of the times we see really sensational headlines, and the first thing I want people to do is take a pause and see if they can identify what the original study is. So sometimes you'll see something that seems too simple, seems too good to be true. Take a pause right there and see if you can find a citation for it to find what the original article's about. Once you get that original article, there's a couple things that you can do to determine if it's a good one and then what to do with it. So you'll want to know who conducted the research. Is the research being done based on a particular drug, and is the drug company the one running it? Sometimes our financial ties to a study bias us, whether it's intentional or not. So a study will tell you who the identities of commercial, non-commercial organizations are that have contributed to funding, services, or materials for that study.
Do most medical studies sort of look the same, and can we turn to some sort of summary or abstract to kind of get the basic information for those of us who aren't so science-y?
So a lot of articles are going to be structured. And so the top of an article should have what their method was, what the outcome was, and what the conclusion is. It should have a little bit of a digest right on top, and it should let you know what kind of study it is.
Now, you mentioned looking for that primary source, first of all, to see who's funding the study, to see where that study's coming from, what is the motivation for that study being taken. But how can we know as the average person if a study is accurate or not?
Well, that is a tricky one. You'll want to know when it was completed so that you can know if it was recent. Even if it's a new headline, it could be based on an old study. We really want things that are based within the last 5 years. The other thing that you'll want to know is how many subjects were in the study. So was it based on 5 people, 50, 500? Usually the more participants that were in the study really increases the validity. The other thing that people really need to do is determine if it was human subjects or if it was rodents. A lot of early science is based on rats, mice, and those aren't things that you're going to be able to roll easily to your healthcare provider and ask them to implement in your care that next day. That's something that's an important step toward a breakthrough, but it isn't the breakthrough that you're looking for.
And you mentioned headlines. We get sensational headlines about medical discoveries. But if it's just one study that so-called proves something, how seriously should we take it, or how much weight should we give just one study?
You really want to see studies that were able to get duplicated results. So you'll really want to see a study that's been able to be recreated over and over. That's really where having a conversation with your healthcare provider is. So I love being able to connect people to healthcare information, a recent study, something about that, but you really need that information hand in hand with your healthcare provider to be able to decide how to change your healthcare plan.
Are there some go-tos for just reliable organizations that publish studies versus, you know, some places you may or may not recommend so much?
So one place that I always recommend is Medline Plus, by the National Network of Libraries of Medicine and National Institute of Health. Those are the folks that are really going to point you in the right direction. It's going to be information that's for the right audience. They usually have a great reading level, and they're always validated. The other resource that you've got right in the community is librarians. So Upstate Health Sciences Library We're open to the public, and all of our services are complimentary. So you could call a librarian and say, hey, I heard this headline. Can you point me to the original article?
And if you do find some health study online, some research about something you're concerned about with your own health, how do you think it is the best way to present that to your medical practitioner without seeming like, you know, you feel like you might know more than them?
Well, the first thing that you need to know is that you are driving your healthcare. So that impetus for people to feel really nervous or kind of deferential to their healthcare providers, you are not going in as a passive consumer to your healthcare. You're an equal partner. So first of all, feel really good about having that in hand, being prepared. It not only helps the physician or nurse understand what your interests are, but it's going to help you understand how to navigate your healthcare concern with them. I never want anybody to make a change in their healthcare based on an article. So you definitely want to do it hand in hand. Don't see a headline and then suddenly drop one of your medications without talking to your doc first.
Or start taking something without talking to your doctor first, right?
Absolutely. So there are a lot of over-counter things that can really impact the efficacy of the prescription medications that you're on. So you don't want to add anything or change anything without talking to somebody.
I once had a doctor tell me you either need to do no research or do complete research about something because somewhere in the middle you're going to get misled. Do you think that's good advice?
I don't want to contradict him completely, but there is no harm in dipping a toe in. I don't think it would be good to be completely ignorant of what your concerns are. I don't think it's good for you. You're going to be nervous. It's totally okay to dip a toe in as long as you're not making any changes first. You should feel really comfortable knowing a little bit, especially if you're the person in your family that takes care of everybody. If you're the one that everybody goes to, hey, I've got a little bit of a cold. Hey, I stubbed my toe. Hey, do you think I need to go to urgent care for this? You need to know a little bit about everything. You need to be a jack of all trades when it comes to information. So no, I think that it's totally okay to take a look at some studies, break down some headlines. The other big risk that people come into is they see something on social media that looks really savvy, really clean, and they forward it without thinking. That's another opportunity for you to take a pause and see what that information is based on.
Well, I think you've got some real practical advice for us. Thanks so much for joining us today, Olivia.
I was happy to be here. Thank you.
Librarian Olivia Sestina spoke to us from the Health Sciences Library at Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, which is open to the public.
The inspiration for our next segment, where we bring you the latest in health and wellness, comes from an article in Politico. According to our next guest, connecting your medical data could be the next big payoff.
Having electronic medical records versus the old paper trail of tests, vaccinations, and office visits pays off when it comes time to go to a specialist or move to a new primary care provider. But there are still obstacles in the way of making our information available to the doctors and practitioners who need it.
I'm reminded of our past interview with Amar Gupta. He reminded us that not all health information systems are compatible, and sometimes their usefulness deteriorates across the country or even state lines.
Exactly. This time we speak to Arthur Allen about what he sees as some of those older obstacles and what's currently in the way of the best possible patient outcomes. Allen is the e-health editor for Politico Pro. He says on the face of it, having medical records available electronically is beneficial.
Potentially being on a computer means that you can share data, you can send data from one doctor to another, to an insurer, to whoever, and share it with patients too on their phones or home computers. But unfortunately, that hasn't happened as much as people had hoped. And the reason, probably the primary reason, is not the technical problems in sharing this data, but those have really started to be solved, and we're now a situation where if you're a doctor, the way you traditionally practice, you get paid for a procedure, you get paid for visiting, for a patient coming. You don't get paid for, you know, sending them on or sharing the data, and your healthcare system that you're part of might not want you to be freely sharing that information, because then the patient starts going to another doctor and another system, they lose out on the money.
Allen says there needs to be some kind of regulatory pressure to almost force medical systems to do that kind of sharing. If not, patients are stuck navigating the system on their own and ultimately costing hospitals much more. Allen tells the story of one patient in particular, Ronald Presley, who didn't have many options when it came to his care.
Basically, he just found that his only home away from home, you could say, was at the emergency room. And, you know, emergency rooms are incredibly expensive. I mean, it's thousands of dollars for any kind of visit. And then when this leads to an admission into the hospital, you know, a bed is also thousands and thousands just for being there, let alone all the tests and everything else that goes into it.
And because Medicare and Medicaid pick up so much of the bill for these, you know, high utilizers of emergency rooms, you write that these systems should come up with a new way to treat these kinds of patients. So why does it make sense for us to look at treating these patients in a different way? And what are you suggesting?
Right. Well, in theory, anyway, it should be of benefit to sort of the payers, which is in this case taxpayers, to the hospital, which takes care of these people, and to the patient, to basically sort of provide more wraparound services that are just taking care of them, keeping them out of the hospital, keeping them more healthy, and, you know, basically doing things to improve their lives overall, while at the same time avoiding these expensive treatment episodes in the hospital.
So in Ronald Presley's case, what was his backstory? How did he end up in this situation?
Here's Alan with more on Presley.
You know, he has lots of issues, but there's a lot of humanity there. I mean, you appreciate everybody's got their own story. So in his case, he didn't have the means to take care of himself. A lot of it was the anxiety and also just this unstable living situation. I think he's finally gotten into an apartment, although interestingly, he called me and said that his caseworker had been laid off, and he's very worried that, like, no one's going to be able to help him now sort of navigate the systems. It's worth saying, you know, we have these very complicated systems where patients often don't know who to turn to, they don't know what's going to cost them what, and doctors don't communicate with each other in ways that's sort of surprising. So bringing this all together is clearly a really important thing for our healthcare system to do.
Presley is what they call a frequent flyer in emergency rooms. These patients, who are admitted often and usually for things that could be addressed with preventive medicine, cost the healthcare system a lot of money.
But if the patient has unstable living conditions or isn't able to keep a job, how can they get that kind of preventive care regularly? Alan mentioned a caseworker for Presley. Is there an argument to be made for changing the way care is provided?
In Alan's opinion, yes. That's what got Presley some level of stability when it came to healthcare and, in turn, his life.
Social workers or care managers, or, you know, the profession of the person isn't as important as it is of just them developing a relationship with this patient. So it's interesting. It's kind of a mixture of high tech and touch and, you know, low tech that's needed to keep these people out of the hospital and then potentially to improve their lives as well and to lower the cost that we're all paying for these kinds of visits.
Alan brought it all together for us by revealing one way Presley's care providers were able to stay in communication. Turns out it's not just the availability of medical records that matters, but also how the information is presented.
The big electronic health record vendors, which are, you know, run by billionaires and have gotten vast amounts of money, it hasn't always been a big incentive for them to share data among each other. So if there are three hospitals and they all have one electronic health record vendor, chances are they can probably share data pretty well. But if you're on one vendor, let's call it Epic, and the hospital across the street is on another, let's say Cerner, those are the two biggest vendors, chances are that they don't share very well, although there are exceptions. And so, interestingly, these little companies, which have, you know, a fraction of the number of employees or, you know, the amount of money, have sort of started providing these quick hit ways of linking hospitals and doctors in communities with limited but very key pieces of information.
So by getting some of the information, maybe the information that's more useful, more important, these companies are trying to treat patients in a better way?
They are, and Alan thinks that in combination with other things going on in information technology, we could see some changes down the line.
This data sharing won't be as obvious to patients, to people who aren't really sick. I think a lot of it is focused on the patients who are the most expensive, and that can be people, you know, who are really in poor socioeconomic situation and so have come to depend on emergency rooms for their care and even to, like, get out of the rain, which is not uncommon, or to get out of a hectic situation where there's violence in their home or this kind of thing. And that is definitely underway, that process of sort of bringing more of these other social services to bear when you have a patient who obviously is plagued not only by a medical condition, but by other problems in their life.
Allen's article, Connecting Your Medical Data Could Be the Next Big Payoff, can be found in Politico Pro. Arthur Allen is e-health editor for Politico Pro. He's written for various publications, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many more. Allen is also author of 3 books.
Thanks for tuning in to Take Care. You can find all of today's interviews online at WRVO.org. Audio is available there, as well as on iTunes as a podcast. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, email us at takecare@wrvo.org.
Take Care is produced by WRVO Public Media with the help of Jason Smith, Catherine Loper, Mark Lavonier, and Leah Landry. Mark also composed and performed our theme music. Support for Take Care comes from the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith. Thanks for joining us for Take Care.